Hello and welcome to the A440 podcast, the one music podcast everyone can get in tune with. I'm your host, Charles Fiore. This season on the A440 podcast, we've been delving into people's obsessions, kind of looking under the hood, if you will, to see what makes people tick, why they work with music the way they do. So, since we've been focusing so much on obsessions, I thought I'd share with you one of mine. The first time I saw Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, it had a profound influence on me. I was eight or nine. I saw a local high school production. But that is the first time I remember being just absolutely floored, stirred by the power of theater. And to me, that kid who played Joseph, whoever he was the coolest guy ever. And I immediately had the friend who took me to this show copy the Broadway cast recording for me on cassette tape, and I wore that thing out. I still remember, you know, the whole show didn't quite fit on a 60-minute tape, so the last 15 minutes or so were on a second mixtape. The Broadway cast recording that I had was the 1982 production, which to me is still the gold standard, but I'm getting ahead of myself. Now, Jesus Christ Superstar, that was a 1970 rock opera nominated for 5 Tonys, won the Drama Desk Award for Most Promising Composer, who was Andrew Lloyd Webber, lyrics by Tim Rice. Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat was also written by Andrew Lloyd Webber, with lyrics by Tim Rice, on the heels of their success with Jesus Christ Superstar. One can kind of imagine them at the bar together in the early 70s. I guess we ought to milk this Bible thing for all it's worth, huh? So, Joseph. Well, that's not really how it went down. They'd actually been working on Joseph in workshops since the late 1960s. They workshopped Joseph in the early 1970s at different colleges and released a half-hour-long cast recording in 1973. After the success of Jesus Christ Superstar, Joseph, Dreamcoat, was billed as a follow-up. And what a follow-up! The show garnered 6 Tony nominations. And while today, JC Superstar rocks in a way that only things from the early 70s can truly rock, it is a dated piece of musical theater. It's not unlike other later Webber productions, like Phantom of the Opera, you know, with the rock and drum pad, that frankly sounded dated the minute it debuted. But somehow, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat has proven the more adaptable score, and I would argue it stands as Webber's greatest work. The score has proven itself able to be updated musically with the times. Maybe because there are so many musical styles in the show, from country western to calypso to soaring ballads. Maybe the story is just somehow more timeless, the script offering up just a little bit more room to breathe and so for directors to modernize and make relevant to the current times. Whatever the case, there are differences among productions and decades. And when you see it enough, as I have, you begin to judge each production on what it does and does not include. You look for your favorite moments, sigh with disappointment if they don't materialize, and find yourself gleefully surprised when a staging or voicing or instrumentation, you know, catches you off guard. So for whatever reason, even after more than 30 years since I first sat in the audience for that high school production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, I still sometimes listen to it and get shivers. It has persisted for me and for many, many other people. I've seen Joseph too many times to count. I've acted in Joseph as Reuben, the eldest of the children of Israel. Shout out to the Marymount Players in Marymount, Ohio, circa 1995. And I've run Spotlight for Joseph at a regional theater. So that adds up to countless rehearsals, countless approaches. It's one of my daughter's favorite things to listen to. So I can pretty much sing the whole show backwards. Now, like I said, Webber and Rice workshopped Joseph for a few years before releasing a half-hour-long version cast recording in 1973. There are some key differences in the show from how the show eventually debuted on Broadway. The biggest change is that originally the narrator was male. In every subsequent version, the narrator is female. And this is super important, I feel like, because first of all, because it takes place in the Old Testament and women were kind of written out of the Bible in general, there aren't that many female characters in the story of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Basically, you get Potiphar's wife, and she's kind of a villain and frames Joseph, you know? So not a lot of redeeming, no redeeming female characters in Joseph. So having the narrator be female, super important. It also has the added musical benefit of giving a little bit of more range, vocal range, texture, and frankly, if it's cast right, soul. There are differences between the songs, which I'll get into later as we walk through the show. I'm sure I am going to run afoul of all kinds of copyright protection. So Andrew Lloyd Webber, it's a440pod@gmail.com if you want to shoot me an email. Anyway, we're going to look at these songs. We'll compare them across decades. And the biggest musical difference to me in 1973, it sort of has that, what I kind of like to think of as a California country style, sort of like America or, you know, early Eagles, that kind of thing. I think I'm on record here on this show as calling 1973 the best year for music in the history of music. I guess there's an exception to every rule. This early cast recording of Joseph would maybe beg to differ. Maybe offer a counter narrative to my personal history of music. That said, it was an important first step. Nobody remembers the original Kindle, even though that was outdated the minute it rolled out. No one really remembers this 1973 version of Joseph either, except for nerds like me who like to go back and compare song by song to more modern versions.
Guess what? In his bed, Pharaoh had an uneasy night. He had a dream that pinned him to his sheets with fright. No one knew the meaning.
With Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, you know right from the top of the show what kind of night you're in for. On the official cast albums, many professional productions, there is a prologue sung by the narrator. However, this prologue is not available to amateur productions. The licensing rights aren't available to amateur production, presumably to differentiate amateur from professional versions of the show. So anything less than professional theater is left with an interesting dilemma. They can either not do the prologue, which is what the Marymount Players did when I performed in 1995. We didn't do the prologue. Or they can thumb their noses at the law and do the prologue anyway, assuming, you know, no one from the musical company, the rights holders, are going to be in the audience. So if you find yourself at a production of Joseph and the lights go down and the first thing you hear is this, not this, you know you might be in for a long night. The version I listen to nowadays because my daughter prefers it, and yes, she can tell the difference between decades. You best not try and slide the 1982 version past her, or you'll get an earful, is the 1991 Canadian cast with Donny Osmond as Joseph. Now, say what you want about Donny Osmond, but he's a terrific Joseph. Strong when he needs to be, never can't be. In the second half of the show, especially, this version hits its stride. He gave over 2,000 performances as Joseph and starred in the film version. Now, I say second half because there's not officially an intermission in the script. The show runs less than 90 minutes on the page. Sometimes production houses feel the need to break after Go, 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 Joseph because maybe they worry people don't feel like they get their money's worth otherwise. But for me, 90 minutes is the perfect amount of time for any theater, maybe especially musicals. 90 minutes, no intermission, let's go. But I'm weird like that. I also kind of prefer novellas and miniseries and races over non-standard distances. The one thing the 1991 version does that drives me batty is inserts "any dream will do" after the narration. Now this strikes me as insane. Joseph, out on stage, singing triumphantly before the show even begins. Productions do this, of course, to lengthen the show and provide some kind of overture, but to me, it drives me nuts when productions do this. I usually try to skip it when we're listening to it in the car. I mean, we get to hear the whole song again at the end as the denouement, where it actually makes sense. So for those of you who don't know your Judeo-Christian history, Joseph was one of 12 sons of Jacob. Because Joseph was Jacob's favorite son, Jacob gives Joseph a coat, a multicolored coat to wear, a coat of many colors, a beautiful jacket, very stylish, and it makes the other brothers insanely jealous. They they barely can tolerate Joseph in the first place. He's super annoying. He also sort of has these prophetic dreams that he feels okay to share with his brothers. He dreams about like there being 11 sheaves of corn that are all bowing to his sheaf of corn. And he dreams that there are 11 stars in the sky all bowing to his star. And the symbolism is not lost on his brothers. I mean, it's very clear what Joseph's driving at, that one day that his dreams, the thing that his dreams mean, of course, is that, one day his brothers will be bowing to him. So finally, his brothers, this coat kind of puts them over the edge. Enough is enough. And they make a plan. They beat Joseph up. They're going to throw him into a pit and leave him to die when all of a sudden Ishmaelites, which are a kind of a traveling caravan, kind of like the Jawas in the original Star Wars, come by, and they decide not to kill their brother, but to go ahead and sell him. And here's a great example of where I'm going to play the intro to the song Poor, Poor Joseph from the 1973 version. Then I'll follow it up. I'll play the intro to the same song from the 1991 version, and you really get a sense of the musical points of view in both those decades.
Next day, far from home, the brothers plan a repulsive crime. Let's us grab him now, do him in my brother's time.
Next day, far from home, the brothers plan the repulsive crime.
Let us grab him now, do him in while we got the time.
Now, one thing the cagey veteran of many Joseph productions looks for at this part of the show is how the production treats the Ishmaelites, because there's a lot of room for creativity. Sometimes, it'll just be the chorus coming by, or it'll just be one person dressed as a kind of traitor. My favorite approach to this is, and it probably doesn't fly today with our ethical boards or what have you, but 20 years, 30 years ago, oftentimes, the Ishmaelites were represented by one or two members of the chorus, as well as a giant pack of Camel cigarettes. And it's just that kind of thing that I really like about Joseph. There's a lot of room to play around with the staging and the costumes and the jokes, things like that. Any cultural reference is just fine in this show. So I kind of prefer the Joe Camel to make an appearance when the Ishmaelites come in, but especially these days, I mean, you never see that anymore. So Joseph's brothers sell him to the Ishmaelites. They fake Joseph's death. They tell their father that Joseph died saving them all from a wild beast. So Joseph is taken to Egypt in chains and sold, where he's bought by a captain named Potiphar. And Potiphar is a small but terrifically awesome role. Potiphar really likes Joseph. Unfortunately, so does Potiphar's wife. And Potiphar's wife tries to seduce Joseph repeatedly, but is repeatedly turned down. I mean, Joseph knows the value of a good thing. He's not going to shit where he sleeps. But eventually, Potiphar's wife gets so frustrated, she makes an accusation. She accuses Joseph of taking advantage of her, and Potiphar flies into a rage and throws Joseph in prison. You got to admire the roar in the 1991 version. Here it goes. And again, just like I said, there's so much variation to the roles, so many ways to personalize the show. Audience members like me come to look for and prefer certain takes on certain roles, certain approaches to the songs. Joseph is thrown in prison, and he sings the song Close Every Door to Me. And it's interesting that among all the versions of this show across the decades, this song remains the most consistent. It's done today, straight up, pretty much the exact way it was done back in 1973. And it's a powerful song, even for non-believers. Because like any good religious song, it sort of transcends itself and speaks of this yearning for release and escape in a way that the best religious songs do. So that suddenly it's not just about the singer's belief system. It's about this universal need for escape, for there to be something better on the other end of our ordeal. So Joseph is in prison. He is eventually joined there by two royal employees, a butler and a baker of Pharaoh. Now, these are some great roles as well. Each comes with their own interpretation. I prefer the 1982 baker, who kind of gives it a Bronx accent. Here, let me show you.
to baskets and ate every slice. Give me the message, like his would be nice.
But the harmonies have improved over the years as well, so like the harmony between the two men in 1991 really can't be beat. Check it out.
We don't think that we will ever see the light of day again. Hey, Joseph, help us if you can.
A lot of room for interpretation here as well. They have some crazy dreams while in prison. Joseph interprets them correctly. The butler gets set free. The baker, gets executed. But Joseph continues to languish in prison until Pharaoh himself begins to have some crazy dreams, and the butler recalls a gentleman he met in prison, a bloke he met in jail, who was hot on dreams and can explain old Pharaoh's tale. So Pharaoh says, well, fetch this Joseph kid, and Joseph is brought before the Pharaoh. Now, a word about the Pharaoh. He is always interpreted as Elvis, usually the Las Vegas Elvis, because his song also is kind of an Elvis country rock song. Here's an example.
Well, welcome to Egypt there, Joseph. Well, I was wandering along.
He's one of the highlights of the show. It's one of the moments people walk away remembering. Again, this version is pretty much the same through the decades. You know, there's only one Elvis, right? So this 1991 version, too, is really where, in this Pharaoh story, where the narrator finally lets loose. Like, up until then, she's been a little tight. She feels a little hesitant to me. And then, from here on into the second half, man, she lets it rip. Here, let me show you what I'm talking about.
From sideways, love, bravo, bravo, worship.
And that narrator was Janet Metz. So Joseph interprets Pharaoh's dreams, and Pharaoh is so impressed, he puts Joseph in charge of his house, of his entire kingdom, second in command only to the Pharaoh. And Joseph sees Egypt through 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine. And Egypt rides it out no problem under Joseph's guidance. Unfortunately, his family back in Canaan is not so lucky. They are starving. And here is one of my favorite songs in the show, Canaan Days, which I saw a touring show of Joseph a couple years ago, and they held the final note for an ungodly amount of time. I've never heard it held so long.
Those Canaan days we used to know, where have they gone, where did
Although the 1991 version of Canaan Days features this terrific scream, which I'd forgotten about.
It's funny, but since we lost Joseph, we've gone to the earth.
Yeah, and there's a lot of interpretive things happening here. Obviously, a lot of room for playing around with the French accents and the French take on this song. One thing I kind of dig about the 1973 recording is this little journey to Egypt that the brothers take. There's this like musical interlude. Check it out. Now, this doesn't appear on the on subsequent albums, but I kind of dig it. I wish it did. 1991, best brothers come to Egypt, best brothers, period, I think. And the second half, like I said, is so strong. Check out this moment from Who's the Thief. Listen to this narrator. Awesome, fantastic. And also, this is just the kind of lyrical genius of the show that I'm talking about. The lyrics, I shall now take them all for a ride. After all, they have tried fratricide as the brothers come to Egypt to beg. I mean, that's great. Those are some great lyrics right there. So what's going on here is that the brothers have come to Egypt to beg for food. They don't know Joseph has risen to the level of power he has. And they actually come to beg from Joseph himself and don't recognize him. Joseph, though, recognizes his brothers. And he's very much moved by their appearance, decides to give them all he asked for. all they asked for, but not before taking them all for a ride to see if they've proven themselves better men. So he plants a golden cup in Benjamin, the youngest brother's sack, and to see what will happen. Will the brothers stand up for Benjamin? Will they come clean with their history of, you know, being bad men? Sure enough, they do rise to Benjamin's defense in this great Calypso number and prove themselves worthy of Joseph's mercy. And of course, he then brings his brothers and his father Jacob to Egypt to live with him from then on. Then, cue any dream will do, cue lights, show over, 90 minutes. Thank you very much. It's a story of redemption, you know. The brothers who did Joseph so much wrong eventually come to offer themselves as a sacrifice in Benjamin's place. Take him, not me. And even though I'm not necessarily a big Andrew Lloyd Webber guy. I think JC Superstar is cool, but dated. I can stomach Evita. I fall asleep when someone even mentions the word Phantom, much less plays music from Phantom of the Opera. And Cats, I mean, the less said about Cats, the better. But Joseph and the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, like I said, has persisted, continues to persist. I don't really know another show that has proven so adaptable to trends and current musical styles or a fan base that goes along with it so willingly. The 1970s reflects that sort of California rock sound. The 1980s embraced the technology of the decade. The 1990s, too, are just a step away from Kids in the Hall and Fresh Prince. The 2000s are like a Disney version of the show, both in the orchestrations and the staging, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just the way it is. You don't see this kind of adaptability or flexibility with other shows. Not with classics like West Side Story, not even with other Andrew Lloyd Webber shows like Phantom or Cats. None of them are chameleon in quite the same way that Joseph is. And while you might argue that other shows pack more emotional punch, there is, in my opinion, no more timeless musical than Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. I suppose that's partly because the story itself is some 3,000 years old. And hey, Sir Elton John, Andrew Lloyd Webber, and Tim Rice are apparently working on an animated version. And one thing you can be sure of, Joseph will adapt just fine to the silver screen. Another thing you can be sure of, I'll be there on opening night. And that's our show. We have one more episode after this one, and that'll be it for season one. Hard to believe we've come so far in so short amount of time. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for bearing with us over the ups and downs. I hope you've enjoyed something in every episode. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, A440Pod, Facebook, A440Pod, and tell your friends. Let's jam again soon.